and the decision-making process at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that governs reactors, radioactive waste, and our shared nuclear future. If you're paying attention to what's going on, you might suspect that top, down, sideways, and every which way but loose, the game is rigged against we the people. So before you allow yourself to dismiss that thought as silly paranoia, consider what it means when someone on the front lines of the struggle tells you,
with such strong opposition in this country to nuclear power, every time there's an application for anything nuclear, it's opposed by watchdog groups at the local, county, state, and national levels, and yet we still lose in these licensing proceedings 99.9% of the time. So you'd think that Congress might take a look into that. They're supposed to make sure that the federal agencies are behaving themselves, and they just don't do it.
Well, when you hear a genuine expert lay it out that succinctly and that accurately, you begin to recognize that it's not paranoia to be concerned, and that there really is a single seat, a single dangerous seat, that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we focus on last week's Nuclear Regulatory Commission hearings on the proposed interim waste storage dump for high-level radioactive waste in New Mexico. We have a sizzling hot interview with Kevin Camps, radioactive waste specialist with Beyond Nuclear. Kevin goes into the official manipulations, legal convolutions, and just plain trickery that's used to discount legitimate concerns about situating a consolidated so-called interim waste storage facility in New Mexico and what's being done by our best legal and activist minds to push back against this madness. We'll also have the start of our series on bizarre facts about Three Mile Island from veteran TMI Alert member and researcher Scott Portsline. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than Randy Rainbow has yet worked into one of his brilliant political song parodies. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, January 29, 2019, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the United States, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission last week held hearings on a proposed high-level nuclear waste storage site in southeastern New Mexico. Opponents held a press conference the day before these hearings to point out that this proposal to store the nation's deadliest and most dangerous radioactive waste is an environmental injustice, could lead to contamination of soil and water, could disrupt the local economy, and will create grave transportation risks across the country and at the proposed site. They went on to add, it is highly likely this waste will be abandoned, and New Mexicans will have to pay to try to take care of it for hundreds of thousands of years. Over a dozen cities and counties have already passed resolutions opposing importation of this waste, and more than 27,000 people submitted comments to the NRC opposing the site. The hearings are meant to determine which parties out of all of the objections get standing in the hearings and will get to make their case in front of the NRC. Kevin Camps, radioactive waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear, said, Holtec, which is the company that is proposed to build this facility, Holtec would store 2.5 times more high-level radioactive waste than is targeted for burial at Yucca Mountain, Nevada. That would mean tens of thousands of high-risk shipments of irradiated nuclear fuel by road, rail, and waterway over decades, passing through most states, many major cities, and the vast majority of U.S. congressional districts. When it comes to high-level radioactive waste transportation, we all live in New Mexico, and Holtec is a national threat. Terry Lodge, an attorney from Toledo, Ohio, spoke in front of the hearings with the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board on behalf of those who live in close proximity to the proposed site, along with concerns of members of communities who live near possible transportation routes. Lodge was there representing a coalition of seven groups, including Don't Waste Michigan, Citizens for Alternatives to Chemical Contamination in Michigan, Public Citizen, which is based in both Texas and D.C., San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace in California, Nuclear Energy Information Service based in Chicago, Illinois, Citizens Environmental Coalition of New York, and the Nuclear Issues Study Group in New Mexico. Lodge argued, one of the most striking omissions from the application papers is the complete lack of discussion, lack of specificity about the transportation routes. He contended that the safety concerns of the 218 million people who live within 50 miles of possible transportation routes should be considered by the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board's parent agency, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Nancy Simmons, an attorney representing the Alliance for Environmental Strategies, focused her arguments on what she believes is a lack of environmental justice analysis in Holtec's application. She said, "It turns out so very often that these types of sites end up in low-income minority communities in the South and on the border. What surprised me was there really wasn't any kind of study of what the potential discriminatory effects may be." Noel Marquez, a member of the Alliance for Environmental Strategies, echoed the concerns about environmental injustice by saying, "The rush is on by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to grant Holtec a license before people realize that we're being sacrificed for another government nuclear experiment." He was referring to the fact that the first nuclear explosion, the Trinity test, took place in Alamogordo, New Mexico, before the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Marquez continued, "We are having to research for ourselves the long-term consequences of this deadly, toxic business." A further argument against this site, being spearheaded by Beyond Nuclear and the other groups, has argued that the Federal Nuclear Waste Policy Act prevents the U.S. government from taking title to privately produced spent nuclear fuel until a final repository is operational, or until hell freezes over, whichever happens first. New Jersey-based Holtec officials have argued that its operations would be, quote, "among the world's safest, most secure storage facilities," end quote. This from the company that supplied the storage system and storage canisters at San Onofre that are only 5/8 of an inch thick and represent a wide range of other safety issues that have been brought up on Nuclear Hot Seat in the past. In all, environmentalists and nuclear watchdog groups raised 42 objections to the application, but now must wait approximately 2 months to find out which of these, if any, is going to be given standing in the hearings with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We will have more on this story in today's featured interview with Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear. Following up on a story that we reported last week about the NRC relicensing the nuclear reactor in Seabrook, New Hampshire, by the end of this month, the NRC has now stated that it will not grant Seabrook Station a license amendment request relative to the plant's degraded concrete or issue a 20-year license extension that was originally planned to be granted by the end of this month. And they will not move forward on that until the public has had a chance to weigh in, though no meeting date has yet been announced. The delay came after separate letters were sent to NRC Chair Christine Svidnicki by Massachusetts U.S. Senators Edward Markey and Elizabeth Warren, and Congressman Seth Moulton, also of Massachusetts, as well as from U.S. Senator Maggie Hassan and Jean Shaheen and Congressman Chris Pappas of New Hampshire. all urged the NRC to reconsider its timeline by saying, there's no reason why the Seabrook License Amendment should be approved before the hearings on degraded concrete in a nuclear reactor, that's my ad, occurs. On January 15, the NRC had announced plans to move quickly to amend and extend the license of the plant, despite ongoing proceedings before the NRC's Atomic Safety and Licensing Board relative to the serious, irreversible problem called alkali silica reaction that is impacting the plant's concrete in all key safety structures. Seabrook, like all currently operating nuclear power plants, was originally designed for a 40-year lifespan specifically because bombardment with radioactive particles would cause embrittlement, meaning a degradation of safety-related materials, including concrete. More NRC news, because last week, on Thursday, January 24th, the NRC approved a weakened version of a rule designed to protect America's nuclear power plants against earthquakes and other natural disasters like the tsunami that triggered the meltdowns at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan in March of 2011. It was blasted by Senator Markey of Massachusetts, who said, when it comes to turning the realities of the Fukushima nuclear disaster into regulations, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been an abject failure for nearly 7 years. He went on to say, this latest decision worsens the dangerous status quo. The draft rule fails to deliver on the promise by the NRC to take action to ensure that what happened in Fukushima would not happen here. The NRC has decided not to enact and not to enforce standards that many nuclear reactor operators have already voluntarily adopted. Senator Markey's blistering attack on the weakened post-Fukushima nuclear safety rules included his statement that it is unacceptable that this abdication of duty has taken place, and especially without allowing the public to weigh in on this vastly different final rule. Instead of learning the lessons of Fukushima's nuclear disaster, we are ignoring them and imperiling the safety of Americans who live near nuclear reactors. Senator Markey also queried the Food and Drug Administration on how the agency ensures that contaminated radioactive food or other agricultural products are prevented from entering the domestic food supply. To which Nuclear Hot Seat can give you the easy answer, Senator Markey. The FDA doesn't. Microsoft founder and billionaire Bill Gates said in his year-end letter last month that he plans to work to persuade U.S. leaders to embrace advanced nuclear technologies as a solution to curbing climate change. That work appears to have begun, as the Washington Post reported last Friday that Gates is making the rounds on Capitol Hill looking for support and billions of dollars. Gates founded the Belleville, Washington-based TerraPower in 2006, and the venture has been working towards building a pilot project for its traveling wave nuclear technology, completely untested, unbuilt, we don't know if the thing will work, and it will not change global warming. Based on reports from congressional staffers, the Post reported that the Microsoft co-founder is telling lawmakers that he personally would invest $1 billion and raise $1 billion more in private capital to go along with the federal funds for TerraPower's pilot plan. Which makes one wonder if there were perhaps some hidden provisions in the 2001 government antitrust suit against Microsoft that was settled for what was then termed a slap on the wrist. And lest we forget about nuclear weapons, the U.S. has begun making a new low-yield nuclear warhead for its Trident missiles that arms control advocates warn could lower the threshold for a nuclear conflict. The National Nuclear Security Administration, which might be a contradiction in terms, announced in an email it had started manufacturing the weapon at its Pantex nuclear weapons plant in Texas, as ordered by Donald Trump's nuclear posture review last year. The NNSA said the first of the new warheads was on schedule to be delivered in a first batch before the end of September 2019. These bombs would deliver an explosive power of 5 kilotons, which supporters say approximately is only a third of the force of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, which makes it sound small, except when you realize that 5 kilotons equals 10 million pounds of TNT. To inject some sanity and understanding into this discussion, we quote from Bob Alvarez. He is an award-winning author and senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. Bob Alvarez said, "Obscured in the promotion of low-yield nukes is the basic fact that they are also lethal radiological weapons capable of poisoning large areas with radioactive fallout. This has been known since the immediate aftermath of the first nuclear test in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. A 10-kiloton low-yield nuclear blast will vaporize everything within a quarter of a square mile, will cause immediate death from radiation within a one-square-mile area, create 113 square miles of forest fires under dry conditions, and kill people from direct radioactive fallout over an area of 314 square miles. The source for this data is FEMA. So much for the so-called safety of what are in the process of being sold to the American people as cute little usable nukes. And in light of this announcement, it's no surprise that it remains 2 minutes to midnight. Citing lack of progress on nuclear risks and climate change dangers as, quote, the new abnormal, the doomsday clock remains at 2 minutes to midnight, as close to the symbolic point of annihilation that the iconic clock has been since 1953 at the height of the Cold War. The decision was announced on January 24th to keep the doomsday clock at 2 minutes before midnight by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Science and Security Board in consultation with the Board of Sponsors, which includes 14 Nobel laureates. The 2019 Doomsday Clock statement notes, "Humanity now faces two simultaneous existential threats, either of which would be cause for extreme concern and immediate attention. These major threats, nuclear weapons and climate change, were exacerbated this past year by the increased use of information warfare to undermine democracy around the world, amplifying risk from these and other threats and putting the future of civilization in extraordinary danger. The new abnormal that we describe and that the world now inhabits is unsustainable and extremely dangerous. The world security condition can be improved if leaders seek change and citizens demand it." We will link to their full statement on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 397. Over to Japan, where Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, says that it has determined that water containing radioactive substances have leaked from a tank at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant for more than 2 years. The company, of course, then went on to say that there is no impact on the environment. Yeah, right. About 300 tons of water have leaked from the tank, containing 120,000 becquerels of tritium per liter. Tritium is the one radioactive element that it is impossible to take out of large quantities of water once it becomes contaminated. 120,000 becquerels of tritium per liter is twice the allowable level for the release of contaminated water at a normally operating nuclear facility. That is not to say that it's a safe level, just that it's an allowable level. TEPCO said that they are now going to work to uncover the cause. Ya think? Prison time has been demanded for three executives at Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant who presided over the worst disaster in nuclear history. There's still an insistence in the media in calling it the worst disaster since Chernobyl, but Chernobyl was only one facility, and we had a triple meltdown in Japan. So at least in this neck of the woods, we consider it the worst nuclear disaster ever. Back to these executives, 5-year jail terms are being sought for these three former executives at TEPCO, the company that was operating the Fukushima nuclear reactors during the accident. The former chair and two former vice presidents are charged with professional negligence, resulting in death and injury. Of course, they have pleaded not guilty. And thus far, they are facing the only charges that have stemmed from what in this story is referred to as the tsunami-sparked reactor meltdowns. But it is known to those who studied Fukushima that the meltdowns began from the earthquake with the breaking of pipes, and that was before the tsunami made it worse. A group of scholars, journalists, and citizens opposed to the 2020 Tokyo Olympics announced a declaration of no thank you to Tokyo Olympics back 2 years ago in 2017. This statement reads in part, "The mega event called Olympics, from its start, has been functioning as a means of suppressing various imminent conflicts in the hosting society. And this function has been accelerated as seen in the ongoing controversial preparations for the event. We have decided to perceive the Tokyo Olympics not as a festival, but as a disaster. It was that Fukushima is under control declaration by Prime Minister Abe that prompted us to do so. That declaration of Abe's does intrinsically symbolize the nature of Tokyo Olympics. All it brings us is disasters to our everyday lives." International anti-Olympic solidarity is growing, and there are many components of it within the anti-nuclear movement. We will keep you up to date on them. But hey, if you want to cope with the problems of Fukushima, you can always drown your sorrow with Fukushima Prefecture sake. It's certainly being promoted as some kind of elixir of the gods by the Japanese government, which is in total and official denial about the Fukushima radiation contamination and existing health risks. At the annual Japan Night reception during the World Economic Forum annual meeting 2019, one of those events where VIPs from around the world attending the conference look forward to the most, six kinds of Fukushima Prefecture sake will be served to complete the feast. At the annual Japan Sake Awards in 2018, Fukushima had 19 brands of sake based on locally grown rice that were awarded the gold prize. It must be that hint of oak and just a soupçon of radioactivity that makes it so special. Word just in that Pope Francis said that he would visit Japan in November of 2019, becoming the first pope to do so since John Paul II nearly 40 years ago. And Japanese Catholics this past Sunday urged Pope Francis to send an anti-nuclear message from Hiroshima and Nagasaki when he travels to those cities. During his stay, Francis reportedly plans to pray for the victims of the 1945 atomic bombings at the two cities. The bombs immediately killed 220,000 people, and the health effects continue to this day. Japanese citizens voiced the concern that the Pope will have sympathy for the movement to abolish nuclear weapons. According to the Pope, has often spoken of the dangers of nuclear weapons. And now, according to local media, the Pope is also considering visiting the Fukushima region. Yuko Honma, an 82-year-old Catholic nun, said, "We also have a great suffering in Fukushima due to the nuclear reactor accident. I hope he will have a chance to visit there too and encourage the victims." To which Nuclear Hot Seat adds, "And maybe, just maybe, he will speak out against nuclear reactors as well." Two articles that we're going to link to, one from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the doomsday clock people, which is entitled "Climate Change Through Nuclear Power Plants? Hardly." It breaks down the contradiction between the climate change argument by pro-nukers and the truth of the matter in some very accessible language, and deserves to be sent to Bill Gates immediately. And a second article from last May that we've just become aware of is out of New Zealand, where it turns out New Zealand soldiers who served in Antarctica in the 1960s and 70s fear they may get cancer because an American nuclear power plant at McMurdo Station leaked, and U.S. servicemen have already died from cancer. In 11 years of operation, there were 438 documented safety problems with the reactor, the most notable being a leak from a cooling unit. Within a month of finding that leak, the U.S. Navy decommissioned the plant. What I find interesting is that McMurdo was nicknamed Nuki Poo. Links will be up at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, 397. And now...
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
People just don't understand about radiation and its dangers, do they? People from all over the United States and even overseas have been traveling to Boulder Basin in Montana to deliberately breathe radioactive air. They sit in the tunnels of a handful of so-called radon health mines, which are decommissioned gold and uranium mines, in order to breathe air tainted with radon and even drinking radon water. Now, radon is the same radioactive chemical element that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency warns about. High concentrations of radon are clearly linked to an increased risk of lung cancer. Tim Driscoll from the University of Sydney and the Occupational and Environmental Cancer Committee at the Cancer Council says that radon is not to be messed with. Quote, if the radon's breathed in, it's in the lung, either in the airways or lodged in the tissue. When it breaks down, alpha particles cause direct damage to the DNA of the lung cells and increase your risk of cancer. And even if you don't get cancer, that DNA damage could be passed down to future generations. Entering into one of these radon mines can give you a blast that is 425 times higher than the safety limit set by the EPA. People say they do this to improve their health. But you know, considering that the average age of the visitors is over 70, and it could be 10 to 20 years before any cancer related to the radon could become manifest, maybe they're off scot-free. But kids, do not try this at home. And that's why anybody who knowingly and willingly travels in order to breathe in radon as though it's going to be a health benefit, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, you know, every week I take a few moments to try to convince you to help out financially with Nuclear Hot Seat. In case you haven't noticed, I am not a natural-born salesperson. And at times it is excruciating to have to ask. But I do, because it truly is the only way I can keep this show going. I want to thank all of you who do donate, be it a one-time impulsive wish to help, or that small and loyal core of you who help on an ongoing basis with a monthly recurring donation of $5 or more. Without your help, this show would have had to fold under its own financial weight a long time ago. So here we are again, and I'm asking again. 3 Mile Island's 40th anniversary is coming up, and I pledged, both on this program and in writing in my book, to be there, to bear witness, to add my voice, and to bring back the coverage. Right now, I'm trying to figure out how that's going to be possible. The difference? It all comes down to the expense. Donations to help with airfare, ground transportation, food, lodgings, and even dog care while I'm away. That's what's going to determine my participation at 3 Mile Island. And whatever comes in has to be over and above the regular monthly, quarterly, and yearly expenses for the show. So if you can help, please, now is the time to send a donation so I can take advantage of lower airfares to get myself to 3 Mile Island. It's easy for you to donate. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button for a one-time donation or to set up an automatic recurring donation of any size. And for those of you who want to support the show in a way that's easy on the budget, on the website there's also a big green donate button that, with just a few clicks, allows you to set up a recurring donation of $5 a month. Please, I need to make a decision about 3 Mile Island in the coming week, so whatever you can do to help now, thank you. Here's this week's featured interview. Last week, we interviewed Don Hancock of Southwest Information and Resource Service. a nuclear watchdog group based in Carlsbad, New Mexico. In that interview, we focused strongly on the waste isolation pilot plant site, but we also covered what were then upcoming hearings by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on the proposed creation of a so-called interim waste storage facility in New Mexico for high-level nuclear waste from the nation's nuclear reactors. As we promised last week, we then spoke with Kevin Camps, nuclear waste specialist for Beyond Nuclear. Kevin was in Albuquerque, as well as involved working overtime for months in preparation for these hearings. He can see straight through the manipulations and continues to help forge the community and activist fight to stop this ill-conceived, consolidated, so-called interim storage facility, or CISF, from being built in New Mexico. I spoke with Kevin the day after the NRC hearings concluded, last Friday, January 25th, 2019.
Kevin Camps.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you've really been in the hot seat, or at least the hot spot in this country, for hearings on the proposed so-called interim waste storage facility in New Mexico. There was a big press conference several days ago. First of all, tell us, how did the press conference go? Was it well attended by the media, and what kind of coverage have you been getting?
Yes. Well, thanks to the hard work of Leona Morgan of Nuclear Issues Study Group, which is Albuquerque-based, as well as Diane DiRigo of NIRS from Washington, D.C., we did have really good media coverage throughout, not just the press conference, but all 3 days, all told, 2 days of hearings. So just one example, we got 2 AP articles, and I just did a quick scan, and sure enough, those got picked up all over the country. And we also got a couple, 3 articles in the Albuquerque Journal, all told, and a bunch of TV coverage. So it's been good media coverage locally, and very fortunately, the word has gone out nationally.
Briefly, go over what the issues were that you were discussing and that have been picked up by the media.
Yes, well, all told, we have 42 legal objections, 42 contentions all told, only because we had limited resources. There's 1,000,001 things wrong with this proposal. So just one example, Beyond Nuclear, echoed by other groups in our coalition, has told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, and even we're now telling the federal courts, this is illegal. This proposal is illegal under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, and it's largely fallen on deaf ears so far at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So to defend ourselves, to cover our behinds legally, we are entering into this licensing board proceeding and telling them at every turn this is illegal. And so we'll see how this goes. As soon as we lose at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Beyond Nuclear is going straight to federal court to say this is illegal and it needs to be stopped right now. But the 1,000,001 things would include the transportation risks, the unsuitability of the site itself, the environmental justice violations. The list goes on and on and on. And we have a great coalition from Alliance for Environmental Strategies in southeastern New Mexico, a local EJ group, Hispanic membership, because that's who the communities are down there. And we've got a coalition of 7 groups from coast to coast, represented by Terry Lodge from Toledo, Ohio. One of those groups is Albuquerque-based Nuclear Issues Study Group, Beyond Nuclear, and then Sierra Club, the oldest and biggest environmental group in the country. And that's our coalition opposing this, as Diane DiRigo of NIRS has pointed out, the largest nuclear waste dump in the world, if it happens.
Even bigger than Yucca Mountain, which is proposed but certainly has not progressed.
2.5 times bigger than Yucca. Yucca is limited to 70,000 metric tons of high-level radioactive waste. This one would be 173,000 metric tons.
So I found it interesting in your comment just now that there seems to be an assumption that you're going to lose at the NRC. What does that mean and what leads to that conclusion?
We will fight as hard as we can. The NRC is completely captured by the industry it's supposed to regulate, perhaps never worse than now. Trump's appointees, Annie Caputo, a former Exelon nuclear lobbyist, and David Wright, the Public Service Commission president in South Carolina, who presided over the waste of $9 billion of ratepayer money on 2 canceled reactors. Those are the latest additions to the commission. So chances are very good that we're going to lose. One would hope that if we can keep this licensing board fight going long enough, that maybe the thing will collapse under its own weight. And that kind of did happen the past couple days. It was obvious to everybody with a fair objective viewpoint on this, that Holtec had really submitted a half-baked proposal. And they got some questions about that, even from the licensing board. I say it's completely rigged against us because it is, but there's just some basic things like, are you talking 100,000 metric tons or 173,000 metric tons? And they couldn't really answer that question very well. It's in the documents both ways. And then another just real zinger and whopper was one of the licensing board judges asked Holtec, its lead attorney, what if there is a leak? How are you going to deal with that? And pretty much he wouldn't answer the question. He said, that's out of scope, Your Honor. We're not going to have a leak. So the hubris, the arrogance is pretty remarkable. That actually got gasps out of the room when that answer was given.
How much community involvement are there in these hearings? Is it mostly the crew that has come in from elsewhere to take a firm stand, or are there members of the community who are there who are going, wait a minute, this is our backyard, what are you doing here?
We had a lot of local support from Albuquerque. In fact, there were protests, vigils, for two of the three mornings with an inflatable mock nuclear waste cask. So they were very visible on a very busy road near the venue where this was held and spreading the word that way. And some of that got captured, like in the AP articles, you know, that went national. You saw the protests. That's what was depicted. And then you had Rose Gardner from Alliance for Environmental Strategies drive 5 hours across the state of New Mexico to be here. And she's one of the people, you know, providing legal standing on the ground in southeastern New Mexico. So we had folks come in from, like I mentioned, Terry Lodge, Toledo, Ohio, Michael Keegan from Don't Waste Michigan, several attorneys from Atlanta, Georgia, who represent Beyond Nuclear, our lead attorney, Diane Curran, from Washington, D.C. So this was a real reflection not only of the local opposition to the dump, but also the national opposition.
Let's roll this back slightly. Give us a picture of what these hearings consisted of and what they are supposed to be determining.
Well, the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board is a quasi-judicial administrative law panel at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So these three panel administrative law judges, one, the chief judge is a lawyer, the other two are technical judges. They are paid by the NRC, and that begins to tell you something. They eat in the NRC cafeteria with the NRC staff on a daily basis. So it is really a pro forma exercise. And if you just look at the history of the ASLB, the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, they have approved 99.9% of all license applications that come before them. That doesn't mean that the facility, whether it's a reactor or a dump, actually happens, because a lot of times the companies go bankrupt, they walk away, it doesn't happen. But it got a license from the NRC. So we just had 2 days where we were trying to defend our legal standing and defend the merits of our contentions, our legal objections. And they make it difficult. Holtec actually objected to everyone's legal standing. Even for Beyond Nuclear, we have a ranching family who's a member of Beyond Nuclear who lives a mile from the property line of the proposed dump and ranches their cattle right up to the fence line. Holtec even challenged our claims of legal standing. So if we don't have legal standing, nobody does, and they would like it that way. The NRC staff was a little bit more reasonable, but not much. They recognized Beyond Nuclear's legal standing, but they challenged the merits of our contention on the illegality of this proceeding. So what they're trying to do is get rid of everybody as best they can, and we will find out probably come late March, early April, the ruling by this administrative law panel, if they're even going to hold hearings, if anybody even has legal standing or a meritorious contention that is worthy of a hearing. But we're working hard, and we're going to try to get there.
You know, Shakespeare wrote that all the world is a stage. And if that's the case, the NRC puts on some of the worst theater that is out there. It sounds like what they're trying to do is put their fingers in their ear for any objection and go, la, 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 we can't hear you. We don't have to hear you. How likely is it they are going to try and get away with that?
Well, you're right about it. It really is theater of the absurd a lot. One of the attorneys who represents an oil company called Fasken, he's an environmental attorney, though, but he was hired by an oil company to defend its mineral rights in the immediate vicinity of the dump. So it's an interesting coalition in that regard, that oil and gas companies who are making a killing in the Permian Basin, they're worried about if this dump blows up, it'll take out their business, and they like their business. They like the money they're making. I mean, we're not pro-fossil fuels by any stretch of the imagination, but I wanted to mention him, Bob Iye, because he made the point yesterday that this proceeding is kind of Kafkaesque, actually. You know, it's like Alice in Wonderland, jam yesterday and jam tomorrow, but never jam today. That's one of the ways they get rid of you is, oh, you're premature in your objection. You have to come back later. You come back later, and they say, well, you're too late now. So they've got all kinds of tricks to trip you up and to get rid of you. Also, Diane Curran, our attorney, in her closing remarks yesterday, used an Alice in Wonderland metaphor of the white rabbit down the rabbit hole. The labyrinthine rules, the ways they get rid of you. So we're trying to avoid those pitfalls.
Where does it go from here? Is it truly a waiting game between now and the NRC announcing what they have determined, or are there further steps that can and will be taken?
No, all lawyers on our side are going to be very busy for the foreseeable future. So, for example, another whopper yesterday was there were about a dozen lies that I can remember that Holtec said at the microphone on the official record. One of them that really got in my craw, and I spent 4 hours trying to figure it out, and NIRS really did tremendous work on this too. They dug up a document, NIRS did, from 20 years ago. The lie was, Your Honors, this Baltimore Tunnel fire of 2001, where a study was done by the state of Nevada, commissioned Dr. Marvin Resnikoff of Radioactive Waste Management Associates to look at a real-world accident, the Baltimore train tunnel fire, that burned for 24 hours at 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. Luckily, there was no nuclear waste on that train, but the question Nevada asked, Dr. Resnikoff asked, was what if there had been nuclear waste on that train? And Holtec's attorney, Jay Silberg, said, Your Honors, this is such a red herring. That route would never be used for nuclear waste transport. As soon as he said that, I just about fell out of my chair, because back in 1999, the Department of Energy draft environmental impact statement for Yucca Mountain actually looked at that train tunnel as a potential route for getting waste out to Yucca Mountain from the Calvert Cliffs Nuclear Power Plant in Maryland. So we spent 4 hours trying to track down that 20-year-old document, get a hold of the map, and we're going to, Terry Lodge, on behalf of his coalition, said, Your Honors, we would like 2 more weeks to address this allegation by Holtec that that route could not be used. So, we have that going, but there's going to be other stuff, too. There's constant amendments to the license application because it's so half-baked. The NRC do what they call requests for additional information. It's kind of like the teacher helping the student pass the test. These strongly worded questions from NRC that indicate to the company what they need to fix in the application to pass muster. And as soon as they do make that correction, they're good to go. And so what we can do is, based on new information appearing, we have 30 days to raise new legal objections, and it's a tremendous burden on our attorneys. It's a tremendous game of cat and mouse and gotcha. We have to be constantly vigilant on the documents front to make sure they're not sneaking something past us.
So with this being an ongoing game of new information, 30 days, new objection, and then it goes through the mill again, are we still expecting the NRC to come up with a ruling on this by, say, sometime in March, or will that continue to delay this process?
More like April at the latest. The chief judge yesterday in his closing remarks said, you know, there's a lot going on, there's a lot of moving parts, there's new motions that the opponents to the dump have just filed, and what that referred to was Tim Judson of NIRS, who's an eagle eye, very vigilant, caught a document that Holtec put out on January 2nd of this year that completely contradicted what Holtec's been saying thus far in this licensing proceeding. And it gets to the heart of Beyond Nuclear's illegality allegation, and that is that Holtec, in its license application, says that the Department of Energy or the nuclear power companies could still own the irradiated nuclear fuel, and that's how we're going to go forward. Liability could be with either Department of Energy or with the nuclear power plants that generated the waste. Well, the thing is, the Department of Energy aspect is not legal. The Nuclear Waste Policy Act says the Department of Energy can't take ownership of this waste until it's an open and operating deep geologic repository, which this is not. So that was one of our requests from Beyond Nuclear is, Your Honors, that has to be stricken from this license application. It's not legal, or this can't go forward. And in their early January review of 2018 is what it was called, Holtec said, we really depend on DOE having ownership of this waste. for this thing to go forward. They were talking to their shareholders. Maybe they were worried about Securities and Exchange Commission rules that you have to honestly communicate with your shareholders what's going on. And we said, Your Honors, Beyond Nuclear said, this has to be cleaned up. They have to get their story straight. And then Terry Lodge, on behalf of his Seven Group Coalition and the Sierra Club, represented by Wally Taylor, they both made a motion in the proceeding that said, Your Honors, this company is talking out both sides of its mouth, and, you know, that's not okay. This proceeding should end if the company is behaving this way. It's called a material false statement that they pointed to. So the chief judge, though, yesterday, Ryerson, said, no matter what else is going on, we're going to issue a ruling by April. We're going to have to cut this off at some point and decide whether there are going to be hearings or not. And so that's what we can expect is early April.
And what are you hoping to come out in April, and what do you actually expect will come out from the NRC?
The NRC staff, which is, truth be told, it's a proponent of this dump. They are right there in support of this dump with the company. Even NRC staff acknowledged that certain groups, Beyond Nuclear and I think Sierra Club, have legal standing. And it's because we found people so close into the site that NRC staff didn't dare say we didn't have standing. Holtec did. They've challenged everybody's standing. But the question is, which contentions are going to get in? And I think some contentions are going to get in. They're going to try to get rid of, incredibly enough, they're going to try to get rid of Alliance for Environmental Strategies, which is the local environmental justice group. So the proceeding itself is a violation of environmental justice. The reason that they've given in their arguments, including NRC staff, is that the attorney for AFES did not approach the standing question properly. So it's a legal technicality that they're going to throw them out on. And that's what they love to do. They love to trip you up on deadlines that you miss, or you didn't go through the paperwork correctly, you're gone. And it's a hyper-strict legal proceeding about the biggest nuclear waste dump in the world that's going to be forced on these Hispanic communities in southeastern New Mexico. And the NRC staff position is, sorry, you didn't fill out your paperwork correctly. You need to leave now. So the rest of our groups, of course, support the environmental justice arguments of AFES, and we'll try to keep them as alive as possible as we go forward.
It is so outrageous that they're deciding and really cherry-picking what they want the arguments to be, or they're in a position to be able to do that, as opposed to saying, look, we have to consider all of these because we're talking about long-term safety, long-term environmental justice, really into the future, because the odds are that that waste is never going to be moved from this so-called interim dump, but it's just going to be left there. It's like, dig it, put it in the ground, forget about it. And we're all going to have to deal with the consequences. How is this even legal for them to be able to say, well, we'll consider this objection but not that objection?
Yeah, I mean, if Congress were to do its job and exercise oversight on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, you'd think that maybe somebody in Congress would look at the approval rate for these nuclear licensees, which I said was 99.9%, and find something wrong with that. I mean, are you kidding me? With such strong opposition in this country to nuclear power, every time there's an application for anything nuclear, it's opposed by watchdog groups at the local, county, state, and national levels, and yet we still lose in these licensing proceedings 99.9% of the time. So you'd think that Congress might take a look into that. They're supposed to make sure that the federal agencies are behaving themselves, and they just don't do it mostly. Although I should say that Barbara Boxer, when she was EPW, Environment Public Works Chair, during the San Onofre scandal of 2012, 2013, she did exercise oversight, and Bernie Sanders and Ed Markey joined her in holding the NRC's feet to the fire, and look what happened at San Onofre. It shut down permanently. So there are good people in Congress. We're going to have to try to educate them and activate them on this runaway nuclear waste train that's coming our direction.
You sound both very frustrated and very revved up. What's your next step?
For listeners all over the country and the world, coming up in June is going to be the draft environmental impact statement portion of this licensing proceeding. And it's another public comment opportunity. And folks in New Mexico really need to get their elected officials. And New Mexico turned blue last election day, which is good news on this issue. Get elected officials to make public comments, get the public to make comments. And in the earlier scoping public comments last spring, we broke a record on this subject matter. We had 30,000 public comments opposed to this dump. So we need to do that all over again, just bigger and better this time. And people all over the United States, and I would say in other countries, certainly Mexico, Mexico's not that far from this dump. And if this dump were to have a catastrophic radioactivity release and the wind was blowing towards Mexico, they would be severely impacted. So we just got to pour public comments into the NRC and let it be known that the people of this continent are opposed to this proposal.
Kevin, we will do everything in our power here at Nuclear Hot Seat to keep people informed on these issues. Feel free to give me a call at any time to give us an update on it. And when you need people to sign on to any petition or a public comment period, we'll call out the troops to be in support.
Super. Thank you so much for that.
And thank you so much for joining us this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
That was Kevin Camps, Nuclear Waste Specialist for Beyond Nuclear. This battle over the proposed consolidated so-called interim storage facility is far from over, and we will be covering it on Nuclear Hot Seat. Now for a second little feature. The 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear accident is coming up this March 28th. As part of the commemoration, Nuclear Hot Seat will be running a series of features on the accident. This first is by Scott Portsline of Three Mile Island Alert, the first half of what he's calling 10 Bizarre Facts About Three Mile Island. And they're things you don't normally get a chance to hear about America's worst nuclear reactor accident.
I'm going to tell you about 10 bizarre facts regarding the operations at Three Mile Island when they had their accident in 1979. And when you start to put them all together, you realize this was an accident waiting to happen. Number one, the head of Three Mile Island's training department did not have a reactor operator's license. Bizarre fact number two, after his appointment as the head of the training department, he spent half of his time and later all of his time studying for his license. And in November 1978, that's right before the accident, he took the examination and he failed it. Bizarre fact number four, he had someone else take half of the requalification examination for his license renewal. So he was guilty of falsification there. That's a felony too. I don't know if he was charged with a felony or not. Bizarre fact number five, TMI employee attendance for the training classes had declined to 30% at the time of the meltdown.
Scott Portsline of Three Mile Island Alert. Scott's got probably a million of these tidbits, and he will share the next five of them on an upcoming Nuclear Hot Seat. Here's today's final thought. We're heading into Nuclear Disaster Anniversary Alley. Fukushima on March 11, Three Mile Island on March 28, and Chernobyl on April 26. All these anniversaries provide an opportunity to wake up your local media about nuclear issues in your area. It's the one time they actually pay attention, even if it's only to have what is probably by now a severely understaffed newsroom at your broadcast center or your local newspaper to run a wire service story. If you are lucky enough to have a local group that's active in your area, or if you as an individual want to make people more aware of the nuclear issues you face, you can get your local angle tacked onto whatever coverage they may be planning. Now, you can bet the nuclear industry has its well-oiled, well-moneyed PR machine ready to steamroll any attempt at covering a point of view that contradicts their views. But that doesn't mean a single letter to the editor or local story can't knock the knees out from under them. This is a heads up to prep yourself as we get closer. Nuclear Hot Seat will continue to do everything that we can to keep these issues front and center and give you material that you can send on to local media in your area to boost whatever coverage they may be doing. But it's up to you to get this information out in front of the unwashed masses, the people who don't have access to anything except nuclear propaganda or dead silence. So do what you can. That's all any of us can do. And together, we will make the difference. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 29, 2019. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, who is our friend Hervé Courtois, miningawareness.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear, abcnews.go.com, Albuquerque Journal, c-10.org, OC Register, Bob Alvarez, The Guardian, Times Free Press, GeekWire.com, News.com.au, Professor Norma Field, JapanTimes.co.jp, The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, The Cubicle Drones Who Grind Out Press Releases for World Nuclear News, and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. A big shout-out to all of you who listen to Nuclear Hot Seat, be it something that you download in one of the 123 countries around the world where that happens, or by listening on our growing network of support through the Pacifica AudioPort Broadcast Network. You show your love for life on this planet by being willing to know the truth about nuclear and then acting upon it. And I got to tell you, I wouldn't want to be on this journey without you. If you haven't yet done so, visit the Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook page. It's the blog page, not the podcast page. They did something weird with that, and it kind of went away. If you haven't stopped by yet, please come on down, check it out, click like, follow us, feel free to post and share. And you can find our back episodes, all 396 of them, at nuclearhotseat.com. If, when you put in the URL, you add /blog, you'll be able to scan 10 episodes at a time, or you can check it out by date. And if you want to learn more about my book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from 3 Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat, put in /book to the URL, and you'll find out all you need to know. It is available on Amazon. Theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weber, accompaniment by John Barnard, recorded at Winslow Court Studio in Hollywood. Now, if you want to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's easy. You go to the website, nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow box, and sign up for a weekly email link to the latest show. We don't bug you, we just send you the one notice so you never have to miss another episode. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Truly, this is where we find some of our best stories and some of our best interviewees. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment and send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. We will really appreciate your support. Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019. Libby Halevi and Hartestree Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestree Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that dangerously radioactive nuclear waste is forever, which means there's no nuclear energy that is clean, green, or sustainable, no matter what the industry and its high-priced lobbyists say. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.